Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
I'm excited to be reconnecting with best-selling author Kostya Kennedy, who was my guest for the morning show to talk about a very important book of his called Lasting Impact, One Team, One Season, and What Happens When Our Sons Play Football, a very interesting book about the risks of football, and but also the strong hold that it has over a large swath of the American public, including plenty of young people who want to play this game despite its risks. And I'm reconnecting now with Kostya Kennedy to talk about his latest book, which is actually published by Sports Illustrated, titled The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. It is a marvelous book that celebrates the sport of baseball in very striking fashion by presenting an array of 100 different photographs, many of which capture some of the most important superstars of the game and or critical moments in baseball history. And some of these photographs, on the other hand, capture moments that are, in a sense, much more ordinary and everyday, but help illuminate the public's love of baseball and the special hold that this sport has on so much of the public. It's beautifully done, and I'm excited to be able to speak with Kostya Kennedy about this collection from Sports Illustrated again, The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. Kostya Kennedy, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks so much, Greg. It's great to be on with you.
I'm really impressed with this book. You wrote the foreword to it. Is that your primary involvement in this book, or did you have any hand in the selection of these actual 100 photographs?
No, actually, I did write the foreword, as you mentioned. I was the editor of the book throughout. So I, of course, with a team, with a photo editor and a designer and a couple of other people, but we selected the photos and tried to weave together a bit of a narrative, photograph by photograph, of this wonderful game.
Right. You've made great selections, and we'll talk about some of the specific choices in just a moment. I wonder if you could maybe expand on a really great quote that you include from someone who was a former colleague of yours at Sports Illustrated for about a quarter of a century, Ronald Modra, who says, "When you're shooting baseball, you're waiting. You're waiting, and you're attentive." Explain how, especially once upon a time, being a photographer for the game of baseball was, in such large measure, a waiting game.
Yeah, it's a wonderful quote, and I included that in the foreword of the book because it sums up a lot of the challenge. Ron's a wonderful photographer. I was able, as a senior writer at Sports Illustrated for a long time, and we'd be on stories together. You know, in baseball, perhaps more than any other mainstream sport, you don't know really where the action's going to be, particularly in the field, right? You can get a pitcher in his windup, you know you can get a batter in his stance, but if you're looking for a great fielding play in particular, or a play at the base, it's often difficult to know. There's no way to know where it's going to happen, so you have to get a little lucky. And baseball, as we know, you know, what Ron said about taking photographs is also a little bit of what we do as consumers and viewers and those of us who love the game. There are moments of intense action that are very quick, and then you're sort of waiting to see what develops in between. So as he mentioned, when he was shooting the Yankees, for example, in the late 70s and early 80s, when the Yankees were in the field, he would often just train his camera on Greg Nettles, who played third base and was a wonderfully acrobatic and elegant fielder at third base, and he felt he had a good chance of getting a good picture if the ball was hit to him. Now, of course, the ball's only hit to him a few times a game, so it's a risk-reward situation, But he felt, and other photographers who I spoke to felt, that when you're shooting baseball, if you spend a day there and you get one or two really good or even great photographs of the kind that sort of elevate outside the game, it's been a great day, and that's what you can hope for.
Right. I really appreciate some of what you explain in the introduction to the book about how these 100 photographs were selected and how this is, for one thing, by no means the 100 most famous baseball photographs. In a sense, although that would be a great book, but I don't think that would be nearly as interesting a book as this book is, which certainly does have its share of famous photographs from baseball. But that's not all this is. This book is more than that. Explain a little further what went into your thinking process, you and those who helped you select these 100 photographs.
Yeah, it was a big challenge, right? And you start off with the challenge of getting 100 photographs, and you could take it in any number of directions, of course, as you're suggesting in your question. So baseball's about to turn 150. The first openly professional baseball team with the Red Stockings in 1869, and we were using this opportunity, and are using it, to try to tell a narrative of the game, truly to tell a story of baseball over time and over players and over context and over shifts in the game and, of course, over sometimes intersections with the American society at large. So we had sort of a high threshold of what would get in. Of course, the picture had to look pleasing. It had to be aesthetically beautiful or compelling in some way. I wanted pictures to be those that you could stay with a little bit, or you could come back to and maybe see something new or see something in a different light. So there was some depth to a photograph. And then also there was content was crucial, meaning that it wanted to tell a little bit of a story, have a person who was important to the game there, or a game itself, or a time, or, you know, whether it's showing a bullpen cart because of what an important part of the game that was for a little period in the 70s, or whatever it might be. So we're trying to tell over the whole a narrative and have the pictures connect in some way to their time and to the overall story of the game. I should just mention briefly, with each picture, we have about 250 words of text or so, we hope evocative text, which give a little background and context, a little bit extra to the photograph, so people can really dig in and understand what's happening and what they're looking at.
Right. And I also appreciate the fact that the book is separated by time period. So, for instance, the first section of the book is titled Beginnings, appropriately enough, and spans the years 1869 to 1919. And there are some very, very fascinating pictures in this section that include some early luminaries of the game, including Cy Young and Ty Cobb caught in action. I actually would love to have you say just a quick word about a photograph in this section, which you headline "Beginning of the World." This is a photograph taken in Boston in the fall of 1903, and it is a remarkable image indeed.
Yes, it's a picture of the first World Series games at a place called Huntington Avenue Grounds in Boston, and it's a big, widespread shot. There weren't that you mentioned the Ty Cobb picture from 1910, which was a beautiful action picture. There wasn't that much action in those days as what people shot, but this was not action, but a big, wide angle looking at the field. And what's so remarkable about it is you see all the people who've come to watch the game, and they're just crowding in. They're on the outfield. They're standing on the big slatted wooden fence. They're packed in to see this incredible spectacle, and very close to the field, as one can see, much closer than you would ever have people today. Obviously, you wouldn't have people on the field at all today, but it's an incredible photograph, I think, because it evokes such a time. It evokes the excitement of this new game. It's relatively new. It's 1903. This is the first World Series. Shows so many people there, so close to the game. You can see people aren't. You understand by looking at this picture that people don't hit the ball as far as they do now in those days, because you wouldn't be able to have people so encroached. So there's a lot about it, along with period advertisement signs for a local shoe shop and things like that, which really make it a powerful picture to look at, I think.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you made mention of the fact that we have very few true action shots from the early years of baseball, which makes the image, for instance, of Ty Cobb all the more precious. It's well, you describe it, this wonderful photograph that captures Ty Cobb and his greatness.
Yeah, so he's coming really hard into third base, basically almost barreling over to third baseman. You see the his foot hitting the bag. Again, these pictures become so revealing. You can see that the bag is kind of a soft bag. It's almost a pillow. It's changed a lot over time. And there's dirt flying everywhere. The umpire in the background is looking to make his call on the play. Cobb has an expression of great intensity on his face. And it's an amazing picture because, it's Ty Cobb, right? And we're seeing him in 1910 and at the height of his powers and what he was as the greatest player in the game at that time. And as we were saying, it's also very rare in those days to see action like this. This really stood out. There were some beautiful pictures from that time, like the World Series one we just described, but often the player pictures are portraits on the sideline of a pitcher going into his windup, perhaps, or a batter taking a little bit of a swing. The action photography didn't really begin until the 20s, 30s, and then more so in the 40s and 50s. It was much harder to get because of the quality of camera in those days, and it was just not in vogue, really, to do it nearly as much as it would become.
Right. We're speaking with Kostya Kennedy, the editor of a wonderful new book from Sports Illustrated called The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. I know people will greedily devour the chapter that covers 1920 to 1947, and you title it From Ruth to Robinson. In many ways, that title is all that we need to hear, although there are a whole lot of other luminaries from this period of the game who are captured here as well. I want to just ask you about the photograph that you chose of Babe Ruth. I mean, as you just said, by this point, photography had advanced to the point where there are just countless possibilities, yeah, in terms of great photographs of the wonderful Babe Ruth in action. But I love the photo that you selected, although I've never seen it before. Explain what led you to choose it.
Yeah, so as you say, a player like Ruth or DiMaggio or later on Pete Rose or any number of players, there are many choices you could make. One thing to remember is, so say something like Babe Ruth called shot in the 1932 World Series. There's not really a great picture of it, right? There's a little tiny, grainy image, but there's not a picture that you would even consider including in a book of great photography or as something to really hold up at a good size. But there are many, many pictures of Ruth in many different ways. We chose the picture where he's finishing his mighty swing. You see him sort of in full power. His hips are swiveled. The back of his leg is extended. His front leg, his right leg is bent, and his bat is high on the follow-through. He just hit a home run. He's looking up at it. Both the catcher, who's risen from his crouch, and the umpire also following the flight path of the ball. And you also see the shadows on the dirt there, the shadows of both Ruth and the catcher behind him. It's at Sportsman Park in St. Louis, where Babe and a lot of other people hit quite well against the Browns in those days. And it just seemed you were really seeing Babe Ruth doing what he did. Obviously, he did so many other things, and he was a big, larger-than-life star outside the game, and the way he was so jovial and a raconteur and all that, and also did so much on the field. He could run well, and he was obviously a great pitcher. He did so much well. But the thing that he did, obviously, was hit home runs. And here you're seeing him, the power of Babe Ruth, on just, you know, on just the day in October in 1926, and it's one of his home runs, and it really seemed to encapsulate with this picture to tell the larger story of who Babe Ruth was and what he did for the game.
I love this photograph so much. This whole section is peppered with superstars from Joe DiMaggio to Ted Williams to the legendary Satchel Paige. I really appreciate the thoughtful choice you made to capture the great Lou Gehrig. This is another photograph I've never seen before. I've seen ones like it. There are all kinds of photographs from this powerful, poignant moment when Lou Gehrig bade farewell to the game he loved so much. But describe to our listeners the photograph that is here, and again, why you thought this was the perfect photograph to include.
So it's Lou at Yankee Stadium on July 4th, 1939, and he's on the field with several microphones set up on tripods in front of him, and he's delivering the speech that we've come to know and has made its way into the American lexicon of the luckiest man speech, where he knows that he has ALS, and he's still says he considers himself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. It's a powerful picture for what you see in Lou with his head slightly bent. He's not actually speaking. He's in pause at that moment. And also the men you see behind him looking at him and understanding the courage that they're seeing. Here, the case, you know, Lou Gehrig was an all-time, obviously, great, great, great ball player. There are plenty of pictures of him hitting or fielding or doing something that we could have shown. But what Lou Gehrig did, in the way he faced this disease and in his bravery and composure, really slipped the bounds of the game. And there aren't as many times as one would think that baseball does that. Of course, it's wrapped up into American society, but moments like Lou Gehrig or Jackie Robinson, Roberto Clemente, aren't quite as many as one would think. And this really seemed to be one where he was making a mark not just on the baseball world, but on the world at large, and felt like the right way to honor him and what he's given us.
Right. One very special moment in baseball history was the perfect game thrown by Don Larsen. And please describe the great photograph that is here that captures this moment on October 8th, 1956.
Yeah, one of the things I love about it, so it's he's in the arms of Yogi Berra, Don Larsen is having just finished his perfect game, and it shows you sort of what a big guy Don Larsen is, because Yogi wasn't tall, but Yogi was a big heavy catcher, and it's Don who's picking up Yogi Berra, so it gives you a sense. I think Larsen was about 6'4", and gives you a sense of his size and his strength. And you see people, security people, and everybody spilling onto the field and coming close to them. The Yankees are beginning to celebrate. The Dodgers' first base coach is turning to leave the field. And again, it captures a singular moment. Here was a case when one of the landmark games, you know, one of the 10 or 15 games that will go down as the all-time games in baseball history, there was a great picture of it, and it was a great moment. And Larsen, whose career otherwise might not have merited a telling in the overall story of baseball, but certainly through this October day in 1956, warranted being in there.
Absolutely. I want to mention that there are several photographs that have a local connection to our listeners. For instance, a really interesting picture of the Braves having just moved from Milwaukee to Atlanta, and that story is talked about. There's a great picture of the Kenosha Comets. They were one of the women's teams active during World War II and just after, along with the Racine Belles. But the photograph actually shows some talented women of the Kenosha Comets, and all kinds of wonderful photographs to take us up to the present day. I want to finish real quick by having you talk about a great photograph that is not on the field but in a restaurant. The headline says "The Art of the Craft," and the great Ted Williams is sitting down to a meal with two much younger players. Explain why this image is here. It is wonderful, but why did you want to include it?
You know, it's great that you bring this one up. I think of all these pictures, and when you live with them and look at them, I really love so many of them, and it's hard to choose. But in some ways, this is my favorite photograph, or the one that I think about sometimes when I'm away from the book, as much or more than any others. So it's Williams, as you said, and he's sitting at a lunch table in Florida during spring training of 1986. And he's there with Don Mattingly and Wade Boggs. And this is at the height of the time when Boggs is, you know, multiple-time batting champion, and Mattingly is in the heart of his MVP-caliber seasons. And they're staring at Ted, who's sort of in a half swing because he's talking hitting, and he's showing the way he turns on a pitch. And you can see the way his hands are on top of one another. It's just such an amazing picture about baseball going generation to generation. One beautiful detail of this is that Williams has a cloth napkin tucked over the front of his shirt to preserve his shirt, which is what men of his age and at that time period did. And the younger men aren't doing that, right? And it's just another detail which underscores the different generations, but they're together around baseball. And
you're right.
It's an incredible thing.
And you can kind of see the reverence and respect that is on the faces of these young players sitting in the presence of one of the towering legends of the game. It really is a beautiful image. The whole book is wonderful. Again, it's titled The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. This is published by Sports Illustrated, and the editor, Kostya Kennedy, also responsible for a really nice introduction for the book. Kostya Kennedy, you've done it again, and I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about this wonderful book. Best wishes.
Oh, and to you. Thanks so much for having me on. This was really great. I appreciate the time, and so glad you've enjoying the book.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part 2 is coming up in just a moment. I remember with great fondness a past interview which I did with an author by the name of S.C. Gwynn. He and I spoke about a really marvelous book of his called Empire of the Summer Moon, Quanah Parker and the Rise and Fall of the Comanches, the Most Powerful Indian Tribe in American History. When I saw that S.C. Gwynn had written something else that I had the opportunity to interview him, I was very, very excited. But then quite surprised to see what this newest book was titled. His newest book is called The Perfect Pass, American Genius and the Reinvention of Football. So a book nothing like that first book with which I first encountered Mr. Gwynn. This book, however, turns out to be quite interesting, every bit as interesting as that first book, especially if you are interested in the game of football and wonder how certain aspects of football have risen and fallen in prominence over the years, and in particular, the place of the forward pass, which once upon a time was all but unheard of in the playing of football. And now it is, in a sense, a staple of the game, but not always so. It turns out that one of the unsung heroes when it comes to the forward pass rising in prominence in football is a coach by the name of Hal Mumme. And this is a story about him and about the really difficult road that a lot of football coaches face, far more difficult than most of us ever realize. And it's also about what it means to be a visionary with a game as often tradition-bound as football can be. Once again, the name of this book is The Perfect Pass, American Genius and the Reinvention of Football, published by Scribner, and its author, S.C. Gwynn. S.C. Gwynn, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Well, it's great to be with you again.
I'm glad we can do this. Tell us a little bit about your own connection to the game of football and what that has to do with the writing of this book.
Well, I'm just a good old-fashioned fan. You know, my hero when I was a kid was Johnny Unitas and Baltimore Colts. And, when I moved to Austin, Texas 20 years ago, I just totally got into the Big 12 conference and I'm not one of these completely kind of crazy fans, who flies into different cities to do the fantasy draft and things like that. But I'm pretty much just a fan. And the book came from I went out to do an article about a coach named Mike Leach for Texas Tech back in 2009, who had the hottest offense in America. His quarterbacks had led the NCAA 5 times out of 6 years or something, and nobody could stop this offense. And I just asked him where it came from, and he said, I got to tell you a story about this coach named Hal Mumme in a little tiny school called Iowa Wesleyan back in the 1980s, and that turned out to have actually transformed the game of football.
Hmm. And you say in the kind of the acknowledgement section of the book that as you learned about this coach that nobody had heard of named Hal Mumme, that one of the best things about his intriguing story was its very obscurity. I mean, here is this great story just waiting to be told by somebody like you.
True, and even today, you know, I mean, how many people really have heard of Hal Mumme? Inside the football world, coaches, commentators, former players, he is pretty well known. But to the average rank-and-file football fan, he's not. And, you know, if you go back to there he is at this school in Iowa in 1989, a school with 450 students, you know, possibly the worst football team in America when he takes it over. You know, absolutely, it's complete obscurity. And so when he and his assistant coach Mike Leach are driving around in the off season through the frozen wastes of the Midwest, looking, you know, going to see people and looking for the secret of the forward pass, I just thought, that just sounds like a great story.
And I don't remember where it is in the book, but at one point you characterize Hal Mumme as a genius who irreverently destroyed and recreated the game of football. And that's a really interesting way to think about it, about somebody coming along and, in a sense, destroying the game, not permanently or right. irreparably, of course. But what is behind that choice of words?
So if you look at this, it's the game of football, and okay, it's offense that we're talking about here, but in fact, it's, you know, it's the product of all sorts of systems and ways of thinking about things, and you can really think of how, I do anyway, in the same way that you might think of one of those innovators like, or some of those innovators like Jobs and Wozniak, you know, inventing the Apple computer, or Hewlett and Packard, or people tinkering and being innovative and ingenious with, and indeed what they then do, their creations then do create enormous disruptive damage to traditional systems. You know, if you look at what Hal's offense has done to football today, I mean, you turn on the TV and you're going to see some quarterback throwing the ball 49 times a game for 500 yards and 5 touchdowns. That's his offense. That didn't exist when he started. So it was, he wreaked havoc on defenses all over the country, and he did it by doing things that no one had done before.
Hmm. So describe to our listeners where the book begins. I think it's quite effective. The first chapter is called The Mad Pirate's Revenge, and
right.
it's kind of interesting the way in which you just sort of plunge us into the new reality of football before then, in a sense, kind of explaining where this reality came from. So describe the dramatic game that is at the heart of this chapter.
Okay, so the book starts with 1 minute and 23 seconds to go in November of 2008. And the game being played is Texas Tech, which is sixth ranked, had never been ranked that high before, or not recently anyway, and against University of Texas, number one ranked team, the best quarterback in the country at that point, Colt McCoy. And what I then describe is this incredible air raid offense that, you know, people were starting to get used to, but it had only seen for a few years, that has this ability to, you know, throw the ball 50 or 60 times and put up ungodly numbers of points and yardage on everybody, and no one could stop it. Well, we see this in action in the last minute of the game. And the final, and it's a very famous pass if you live in Texas, the final pass of the game is from Graham Harrell to Michael Crabtree, and a 30-yard pass and tiptoes into the end zone for the victory. And what I try to set up, as you say, is I try to set up, well, here's what this thing looks like. And then we sort of, and indeed, this is now swept through all levels of American football, high school, college in particular, NFL more and more. So I just go back to its origins and say, where did this guy get this idea? How did he implement this system? What was the process actually of transformation? How do you do that?
Hmm. I think it's very intriguing, and I'm really glad that the second chapter of the book is here, titled A Job You Wouldn't Want. And you begin this chapter by saying, in the annals of the American workplace, there are few jobs as thankless, unforgiving, underpaid, overworked, lacking in security, destructive to marriages, and mercilessly competitive as coaching college football. Yes, there is the warm glow that comes from making an impact on the lives of impressionable young athletes, teaching them the virtues of courage, discipline, teamwork, etc. But for the dewy-eyed idealists and everyone else, the more immediate reality is this. And you go on to describe, in really rather brutal detail, all of the ways in which this kind of work can be really kind of soul-crushing. I'm so glad that's there because, you know, it flies in the face of what we sometimes hear about, which is of big schools paying their football coaches gigantic sums of money that dwarf the money paid to, for instance, professors at that same university. But that is just one little sliver of the picture. And what you are describing, of course, is the unhappy reality for the vast majority of college football coaches out there. Tell us more about why you think that is such an important point to make in this book.
Well, it is. I mean, it's a tough sport. It's a tough job, you know, and it's high school coaching is really football coaching is a really tough job, too, except it lacks this one thing, which is the 24/7, 365 need to recruit all the time. And high schools generally don't do that. They basically take whoever lives in their district into their games. But college coaches, you know, the minute the game ends or the season ends, they're on a bus or a plane somewhere to go recruit. And sitting in the living rooms of countless players and guidance counselors and parents and trying to convince people to come. It's a hard job. It's also thankless because, as we all know, when the head coach gets fired, what happens to the assistant coaches? They all get fired. And I found myself in this world of, you know, people who often had 12 jobs in 20 years or even more. And it was tough. People moved around a lot. And when you look at someone like Mike Leach, who's now head coach at Washington State, you look at the hardship of those early years when he made $3,000 a year lived in these miserable, broken-down trailers. It is a very hard job to do. And so Hal, in my description of him, he's not only up against all of tradition of football, trying to build this offense that does mostly passes the ball in a world that only wants to run the ball, but he's also got to deal with just life as a coach, which involves he gets fired, he gets run out of town. It's a tough deal.
Hmm. Well, and for him, it is also a reality that involves a wife and young children. So it's not just that he is subjecting himself to this because he loves the game of football so much and so desperately wants to coach it, but in a sense, he is taking along his wife and kids on this very difficult journey.
They're on the ride, and one of the things you hear and I write about is that, you know, when the typical thing happens, which is, you know, Thanksgiving comes around and the team hasn't done well and the head coach gets fired. And then, of course, all the assistant coaches get the news that they've been fired, too. And often what happens is, if somebody is able to find a new job somewhere, you know, typically the rules are you show up the next day and your family just has to worry about dealing with the problem itself, you know, or whenever anybody hires a coach, they don't really want to hear that the wife, you know, has got to sell the house or relocate the kids from school. And I just heard this from a bunch of coaches' wives. It's a very interesting world of really, I must say, really dedicated people, super, super dedicated people who run this game.
We're speaking with S.C. Gwynn, talking about his book, The Perfect Pass. And before we talk a little more about what Hal Mumme managed to develop, we should touch on the brief history of the game of football that you spell out. And I think the main reason that this is here is for us to have a better sense of sort of the entrenched reality against which this revolutionary-minded coach named Hal Mumme was going to try to work his innovative ideas. in brief at least, just sort of describe the way in which football had a certain character right from the start, which in a sense was very inhospitable to the notion of throwing the ball, and particularly in terms of long forward passes.
Yeah, it goes back to the early days of football. I mean, football started with this kind of bloody scrum in the middle of the field that was just unbelievably violent. And the forward pass was introduced in 1906 mainly as a way to save the game. So many people were dying, you know, 18, 20, 30 people dying a year, 150 with serious life-threatening injuries. And so they introduced it. But the problem was that American football always wanted to regress back to that game. And to this day, it's still portions of it want to do that. So even though there were little explosions of offense, you know, Pop Warner in the Carlisle Indian School, or maybe Notre Dame with Newt Rockne a few years, Sammy Baugh at TCU, Norm Van Brocklin in the NFL with the LA Rams. Basically, football always reverted back to a heavily ground-dominated game. It was a running game. Throwing was something you did on third down, And really, if you look at it, what it finally comes to in the mid-70s is what they call the dead ball era. In 1977, in the NFL, fewer points were scored than at any time since 1942. Fewer passes thrown since the 1950s. It was regressing again, and it was so bad that the NFL changed all the blocking rules to try to save the game again. But this is the era in which this new breed of people, you know, Mouse Davis and the run and shoot, Bill Walsh and the West Coast offense, Hal Mummy, Lavelle Edwards and BYU, these really handful of people that I write about emerge from this kind of dead ball era with these hot new passing offenses.
Right. And I guess part of the point of your book is that some of these innovators are well known to football fans, but somebody like Hal Mummy is not. That is, in a sense, a chapter of this story that was largely untold until your book came along.
Yeah, and there's a lot that's untold in here. I mean, nobody's ever heard of Tiger Ellison. I mean, Tiger Ellison in the 1960s invented a type of offense at a high school in Ohio that uses a lot of the techniques that are the basis for all of the high-powered passing offenses now. And who's ever heard of Tiger Ellison? He had this crazy thing called the Lonesome Polecat. Nobody ever heard of. And yet the techniques, when I go through, you know, his offense was the run and shoot, which actually became very influential. But there's a lot of obscurity here. Very few people really know who Lavelle Edwards is. I mean, they might know his quarterbacks, Jim McMahon, Ty Detmer, Steve Young, but at BYU. But so much of this is rising out of obscurity, and even today, these guys are not household, you know, they're not like Vince Lombardi. Maybe they will be one day, but they're not now.
So in terms of what Hal Mummy came to understand about the game of football and sort of its unrealized potential, I find it really intriguing that it was not just one single moment and a lightning bolt from the sky and suddenly I understand this new way of playing the game of football. You choose to describe it in this particular chapter as a series of four different epiphanies. And these are epiphanies that unfolded over the course of years.
Right.
And in different places and in different circumstances. Is this the way he sees it, or is this the way it made sense to you to frame it?
I don't think he ever saw it in terms of the four, although that's what it is. I mean, these came out of interviews with Hal. In fact, that's what it is. So there were four. One of them was really great, by the way. One of them, this guy is just good as a football coach. So he's the age 29, youngest offensive coordinator in the NCAA Division I. He's at University of Texas at El Paso, which is sort of the French Foreign Legion of college football. Terrible team. One of the worst in the game. They were playing against Brigham Young, BYU, who was the defending national champion, that had this super hot passing offense under Lavelle Edwards. And Hal, I think they were favored by 36 points or something like that, BYU was. Hal, because Hal was at UTEP, who was in the same division, he got to study their film. So he studied and studied and studied, and he tried to copy it. No one told him anything. It was like somebody who found a radio on the ground. You know, you pick it up and try to figure out how it works. And during this game, he unleashes BYU's own passing. This is 1985, passing attack against them, and beats them in one of the greatest upsets in college football history. And the other shoe dropping there is that BYU is so stunned that this guy has done this to them with their plays that they didn't even teach him, that they invite him up, and for years he spends time at the BYU camps, and he learns their system, which becomes the basis of his system. I mean, there's a lot of – I mean, that's what we talk about when we say these epiphanies. You know, that game was an epiphany, that he could do that to the nation's best football team.
Hmm. One thing that is a little difficult to understand about this story is how there could be various people along the way, like this coach out of Ohio, Glenn Tiger Ellison, who writes a book touting some of these revolutionary notions, a book that eventually Hal Mumme reads and is inspired by, but how these innovative thinkers would appear, and yet their innovations would not, in a sense, lead sort of inevitably to this innovation sort of sweeping over the game. And he's not the only one, of course. But so there are these sort of isolated pockets. But what is different about the story of Hal Mumme from some of those other earlier instances?
I think if I had to say what, that's a really good question. Let's look at Sammy Baugh, Dutch Meyer, coach of TCU in the Texas Christian University in the 30s. He had this quarterback named Sammy Baugh, who was maybe the best player who ever lived. And they ran a full spread offense. He ran from a shotgun. They used short ball control passes the way Bill Walsh later did. I mean, it was so far ahead of its time. So you would have thought, man, everybody's going to. But the fact is, hardly anybody did it. And so what was different about Hal? So one of the things that people thought about that offense, or most of these offenses, is they wouldn't be transferable. Not, you know, they wouldn't be transportable. That they would, that somebody like Baugh couldn't be duplicated, or, you know, a receiver couldn't be duplicated. What Hal did, and this was maybe the biggest part of the revolution, was he designed an offense that could be run at the high school level easily. It was dead simple. The simplicity of the thing is most of the genius. It was just dead. So now you can see all over Texas, we're all at air raid offenses, all summer 7-on-7 air raid camps, the whole state's being swept by it. It's because you can teach it, because it's transferable. You can run it at junior colleges and small colleges, and you can run it anywhere you want to. I think if a coach reads my book and takes anything from it, I would think he would take the simplicity. This guy designed a game that was really easy and simple for his players and really complicated and hard for your players.
And it also sounds like a system in which you did not necessarily need a spectacularly gifted quarterback or spectacularly gifted receivers in order for it to be implemented. I mean, you don't have to wait for an Aaron Rodgers to come along.
Exactly, and that's right. I should have said that you do not need that. And what it does is it makes, if you look at that great book, Moneyball, written a few years ago, what it was about, this guy at Oakland who's got $19 million, and New York Yankees have $190 million. And the problem is, how does the little guy in Oakland beat them? That's the problem. And the solution is how he uses statistics. In this case, Hal has these little guys, and how can they beat the big, strong, fast guys? Well, they can beat it through this system, a system that will allow a small quarterback or a receiver that isn't lightning fast to compete. So when you do it right, it levels the playing field, and there's a bit of David Goliath in it, with David and Goliath, which is kind of fun.
Hmm. So a closing question. As we follow the exploits of Hal Mumme, one of the things that we sort of grapple to understand is why he's not more famous than he is. Why, if he ended up being such a brilliant innovator, why, in a sense, at least in the more conventional sense of the words, has his coaching career not been more successful, leading from one triumph to another?
Really, you can see the answer to that question, I think, at Kentucky. So he lights up the world at Iowa Wesleyan at the small college level. Then he goes to Division II, Valdosta State in Georgia, lights up the world, sets all the national records in NCAA D2. He's rewarded with the head coaching job in the SEC at Kentucky, 1997. And he takes his offense, and he beats Alabama and LSU. People said you could not use these video game passing offenses to win in the SEC. How did? Okay, now we're at the peak of his career. Unfortunately, what happens to him is he runs into a recruiting scandal at Kentucky. Not his fault. It was one of his coaches was out making cash payments to high school coaches and very bad things. It didn't prevent Hal from having to resign in the middle of it, even though he was 100% exonerated by the NCAA, but that was a year later. And I think you could say in a lot of ways his career took a turn at that point that it maybe is the main reason why he isn't the coach of the Green Bay Packers right now or something like that. There were some other problems later on, but Kentucky was really his glory and his undoing, unfortunately, for him.
Right. And, of course, we certainly get a sense through the pages of your book that the world of football, just in general, is not always particularly receptive to the ideas of a revolutionary thinker.
No, and it's also a razor-edge job, as we were talking about earlier. I mean, ask, you know, Colin Kaepernick and Les Miles about that, about how quickly things change. You know, Colin Kaepernick at the 49ers he was the second coming last year. Les Miles, a few years ago, was the greatest football genius in the country. They're guys that, you know, they're headed south real fast. So it's a cruel profession, I think. In addition to being, as you say, very unfriendly to people with new ideas who think they're going to throw the ball.
Right. Well, in the meantime, we get to know very much both the man and his intriguing revolutionary ideas, Hal Mumme, in this book, The Perfect Pass, American Genius, and the Reinvention of Football, published by Scribner and the author S.C. Gwynn. S.C. Gwynn, thank you so much for writing this great book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. This has been fun.
Greg, it has been fun. Thank you for such a careful read. It's great to talk to you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, in observation of Giving Tuesday, we're going to be speaking with Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, and several representatives of the Gateway Foundation, and talking about the great work that the foundation does on behalf of Gateway and its students. We'll have a couple of different interviews on Wednesday's morning show, including one with Dr. James Kinchin, choral arts director at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, talking about their performances this upcoming weekend of the Neguza Saba Suite, which is an amazingly colorful and vibrant work that celebrates Kwanzaa. We're also going to be talking about a brand new play that is going to be presented at Parkside this weekend. Thursday's morning show will include a conversation about an exciting sculpture exhibit that is about to open at the Racine Heritage Museum. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and the program is archived on WGTD's website, wgtd.org. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information is available at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Kenosha Unified Schools are closed today because of power outages throughout the district. Racine Unified is in business. Class